The Buick arrives. They're sitting all around the garage. So you're sitting there watching. You see the Buick go in. You don't know who all's in. You figure maybe the Skagley is in.
Hi, this is Dave Schrantweiser from Mob Talk on YouTube. One of my projects we work on with mob expert George Anastasia here in Philadelphia. We talk about everything mob here in Philadelphia and across the East Coast in the United States. And we're here with Gary Jenkins on Gangland Wire.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, hello, all you wiretappers out there. I'm here in the classic old Ice House building in Midtown, Kansas City, in a very cold, icy day, sitting here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Aaron, tonight we're going to do a story, kind of a compare and contrast with the French Connection case, the movie, and the real case. It's one of the first of these types of movies and books that I read in 1971. Robin Moore, who's a pretty well-known nonfiction writer, wrote a book called The French Connection, a true account of cops, narcotics, and international conspiracy. And then he sold it right away to a film company. The director was William Friedkin, pretty well-known director. I'm not going to go through all his screen credits. The screenplay was written by an Ernest Tidyman. I don't know anything about him. I've heard of Friedkin. This film will tell the story of New York City Police Department narcotics detectives, and their names in the movie were Jimmy Popeye Doyle and Buddy Cloudy Russo. Their real-life counterparts were narcotics detectives Eddie Bullets Egan and Sonny Grasso. This film was nominated for 7 Academy Awards and won 5. Got Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Actor for Gene Hackman. It was the first R-rated film to win Best Picture Award. The French Connection holds a pretty significant place in movie history, Aaron, and that is, if you remember, you're not that old, really, but in the 60s, maybe the Thomas Crown Affair was kind of gritty, but wasn't anything like this. Dirty Harry and Serpico and French Connection, those movies in the early 70s ushered in what they called a golden era of gritty, hard-nosed crime dramas, particularly set on the streets of New York City. And there was no, even where the police station where they worked out of, the apartment where the guy lived, except for when they were in a kind of a fancy hotel. They were all gritty and kind of grimy looking. I mean, it was a real deal. The action all took place in at the 70s was a dark and filthy New York City, and not even in the neon signs of Times Square with the, of course, back then in the 70s, it was all peep shows and adult movie theaters in Times Square. But Eddie Egan in real life was a real flamboyant cop. And just like in the movie, they showed him posing as different street people in order to get closer to drug dealers. And in real life, he would pose as a hot dog vendor. He'd pose as a deaf mute sitting on the street, handing out a card saying, I'm deaf and begging money. Posed as a priest and even posed as a Salvation Army Santa Claus in order to make arrest. And Sonny Grasso in real life was just like his film character, just kind of quiet and competent and a determined guy that didn't really have too much to say, but it was always there when you needed him. This film is about a huge heroin operation, bringing heroin in from, actually started out in Turkey or in the Middle East somewhere, probably Turkey, by the Corsican crime families, bring it to Marseille in France and boil it down into powder heroin, and then from Marseille in France, which is a big seaport on the Mediterranean, bring it over to New York City. And it really went down because of blind luck. And I understand that a lot of real life cases go down because of blind luck. Actually, one of the biggest cocaine busts that we ever did, Aaron, and the intelligence unit really came out of a failed wiretap. We did the only wiretap that any city police department's ever done, and I think in the state. St. Louis may have done one, or maybe the Highway Patrol. We had a wiretap law for a short period of time. We put that wire up, and we're listening to him. We got a source that's telling us he's dealing cocaine and getting in kilo-size shipments. We're listening to him. Best thing we can hear is he's talking about watching dirty movies in the back room and trying to call girls and family members and things like that. We're not hearing anything. 30 days later, we serve some search warrants, and we come up with zilch. But during that investigation, we sent a couple of undercovers in to the club, and they bought a small amount of cocaine from a girl that really just hung out in the bar.
Well, she hung out in the bar probably to sell cocaine.
Yeah, but she wasn't connected to the club owner at all. We never picked up that anyway. So they made a couple of undercover buys, small buys, whatever you call it. I can't even remember now. The only thing I can think of is a dime and a nickel bag, but that's not in the cocaine world.
Is it an 8-ball?
Eight ball. That's a lot. That's an eighth of an ounce. That's a lot of. That's a big buy. I can't remember what they call it. Just like one little go around for the evening. That's about $25. A rock, if it was crack.
A bump.
Yeah, probably a bump. I'm not sure. Anyhow, we digress. So
both of us not being cocaine users, we don't really know the terminology.
Right. We needed our last guest in here. She could have told us the terminology on that, I got a feeling. Bubba and his partner went back out. That was a dude, we called him Bubba. He was great undercover. Man, you would never burn him for a cop. They go and pop her after they've got a couple of little buys on her, and they go pop her. So, well, let's make a deal. We can make a deal, but you got to send us to somebody higher up. And she said, well, I have bought some cocaine from this girl, Valerie Alfara, who hangs out at this club once in a while. And she hangs out at where a lot of high-end cocaine folks like to go in the city. The discos, this was after discos, but it was still the kind of upper middle class bars where the cocaine folks go a lot. And so he went out. I sent a guy out. He and an FBI agent, Terry Finn and Larry Tungate, went out, and they talked to this Valerie Alfara, and they pretended like they really had something on her. Larry Tungate will tell the story to this day. He said she turned away and acted like she was fiddling with something. And she turned back and she said, "Well, I guess you're talking about that kilo I sold to that Nigro kid." They kept their cool, and they skillfully proceeded to extract more and more details out of her. And by the end, we ended up taking down one of the larger cocaine recoveries in Kansas City, and certainly the largest. I think it was $250,000 we got out of one of the dudes. It was a little small group of guys that called themselves the Young Italians. They were somewhat peripherally connected to some of your friends over there that have used to come into the restaurant over there, Aaron. Actually,
these weren't the Basta Boys, though.
No, these were. Well, no, they weren't. No, not. Now they really. Well, Nigro was. The Nigro kid was. He was one of the Basta Boys. These were some other guys that were just kind of on the periphery. And that's a whole other story. I'm going to have to tell that story. I've got a newspaper reporter I've talked to about that, and he wants to do that story. Because he thought one of them was getting out of prison, and we collaborated on it, and I helped him get his story together. But then all of a sudden, the guy didn't make parole, so we're waiting. He had to shelve the story for now. Anyhow, back to the French Connection case.
We could talk with him in prison.
No, he ain't the guy that's talking. It's a newspaper reporter who's talking to me. The other guy's not talking. The criminal is not talking. Back to the French Connection case. As I said, you know, it all comes out of Turkey and ends up getting refined into morphine paste and shipped to France, and then they refine it in Marseille and bring it over to the United States. And in the film, Gene Hackman's playing Popeye Doyle and his partner Claudio Russo, which is kind of interesting, played by Roy Scheider. Claudio Russo, the guy's real name was Sonny Grasso, but they called him Claudio Russo in the movie. And they'd been working, they did some narcotics work, and they ended up, I think, in some kind of a confrontation with a narcotics dealer. They have to glamorize the heck out of that stuff, and ended up having a chase and took him down. But later on in the evening, they have stopped by the Coca Cabana Dinner Club, and this is a pretty high-end club in New York City. And they happened to see a guy. It was a real low-level mob guy that Popeye Doyle in the story was supposedly familiar with. So I'm spending a lot of money sitting around a table with a lot of people with his wife. Everybody was dressed to the nines, and they were drinking the high-end champagne and ordering all the, you know, appetizers to dessert and steaks and all the high-end stuff.
And this wasn't the kind of guy who would be normally have the kind of money to do that.
He would normally not be in that place or not dressed in a tuxedo and his wife with all kinds of jewels on in an evening gown. Of course, that's, you know, that's the movies for you. They like to jazz it up a little bit. They follow him away, and they figure out he is really a lower middle class newsstand owner. They watch him and his wife drive home. They go inside, park the car out to the side. They walk into a real small, inexpensive home in New York City, and the husband comes back out in his working clothes. This is like first thing in the morning, like they've been out all night, and he walks down the street and opens his newsstand. Well, you know, that's the kind of thing that would raise your curiosity. It would certainly raise my curiosity. How does this guy live in this double life?
Well, if he was a hot dog vendor, you know he might be, you know, taking bets.
Well, that's what I'm saying. He's got a double life. I knew a pretty successful guy that had a real lucrative auto theft operation once, and he told me, he said, you know, when I go out in public, I drive a really low-end used car. I wear working man's clothes. Now, when I go out of town to take vacations, then I will rent a limo or rent a Rolls Royce or rent some kind of really expensive car, and I'll live, eat in the best places and stay in the best places. But when I'm around Kansas City, I keep this extremely low, poor-looking profile. Of course, part of that's to keep other criminals from thinking he's got a lot of money, too. Now, I told you how the movie started and how they started the French Connection investigation in the movie. But in reality, Eddie Egan and Sonny Grasso were working in the NYPD narcotics unit. And they had received information from an informant that a guy named Pasquale Fuca, that'd be Patsy Fuca, who was connected to the Lucchese crime family, and that he was possibly involved in some kind of heroin smuggling operation. They looked at him, and they found out he was a nephew of Angelo Little Ange Tuminaro, who was a made guy and a member of the Lucchese crime family and known in the Federal Bureau of Narcotics people at the time. That's what they asked for, DEA. The Federal Bureau of Narcotics had him down as a major heroin distributor, who was connected up with French and Corsican mobsters. So they set up a full-court press surveillance on Fuca and his luncheonette, or his newsstand. I'm sorry. Oh, man, he had a luncheonette. I'll take that back. In reality, Fuca didn't have a newsstand. He had a luncheonette.
Well, yeah, the difference between the movie and the real life is one guy had a newsstand in the movie, and in the real-life story, the guy owned a little diner.
He owned a little diner, exactly. Thank you for straightening me out on that, Aaron. I got that mixed up. Anyhow.
I was reading through this before we had met, and it was a little confusing because you kind of go back and forth between talking about the characters in the movie and the plot line and then what the reality of these two real New York, you know, cops are.
Yeah, and that's my intention here is to kind of compare the fictional story with the nonfiction story and see how close they got to it. They set up a full court press on Fuca and his luncheonette. Pretty soon they start seeing a lot of expensive cars stopping and people going in and out and not staying very long. They got enough. That's whenever you're getting a warrant to obtain a wiretap or a wiretap order, that's the kind of surveillance log information that is valuable when you can say, you know, my experience as a narcotics detective, and I've been doing this for 5 years, I've got this informant that says this, I've got this informant that says he's a heroin distributor. I have these many different expensive cars stopping, people going in, staying just a short period of time and leaving again. I've been in there, they're having hushed conversations. I saw them pass a package once. Those kinds of things are what you need to get a wiretap order. So they got a wiretap order on the luncheonette, which turned out to be gold. The Federal Bureau of Narcotics already had intelligence that Tuminaro was using his nephews, Patsy Fuca and Tony Fuca, to handle deliveries to customers in the New York area. We're still in reality here. And Tuminaro, who was controlling this business, either from his home at 24 Rutgers Street in Lower Manhattan. For you New York people, if you live over in Manhattan, you might drop by 24 Rutgers Street and still see if it's still an apartment there. I bet there is. And he also had would be in and out of the mob social clubs that were around in the Mulberry Mott Street areas. This is a, and on one occasion, it was a barbershop that he owned at 144 Clinton Street, which is on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. It's called the Apollo. And actually, in 1964, there was a Senate report that listed him as one of the largest wholesale narcotics traffickers in New York City. So Egan, Popeye, or Eddie Egan and Sonny Grasso, they knew they were onto something. They had all this activity of indicating narcotics trafficking plus intelligence. Got Tumanaro. He'd been arrested in a, what was at that point in time was a historic drug bust that got Carmine Galante, or the Cigar, and a I think a Cuban guy, Joné Ormento and Anthony Mira, along with some others. He had skipped bail for a while and disappeared and came back in town. And later in November 1986, Fortune magazine will still list him as 49th out of the top 50 mob bosses. So Tumanaro was a pretty big deal. His name I had never heard of. He didn't make the papers very much.
Well, we're much like, you know, when you're trying to work a case, you're trying to work your way up the ladder to find the sources.
Yeah, that's what they're doing, too. You find a hot spot like the Luncheonette. You find that he's got these connections with somebody like Tumanaro. You got intelligence that they're doing this, and it's a hot spot. It's like they don't realize that the police know that they're there. Rent an apartment across the street usually, or put a van down the street. It's better to rent an apartment across the street or down the street. Get on the phone and start taking pictures and logging everybody that's coming in and out, maybe following a few of them to see where they go. And it just starts with there. And maybe you find one of them that's got some kind of a case he's caught. Somebody will go in and say, hey, you know, we can work a deal on this. And you don't let them know that you know about is they were once seen at the Luncheonette. And see if you can't work some kind of a deal to get them started. You just got to get them started. Federal Bureau of Narcotics also told Egan and Grasso that Tumanaro and Fuca are kind of peripherally involved in another federal case of heroin importation from France. So they know that this guy's involved in this. They know it's probably coming from France. They're on the phone. Now, in the film, let's go back to the film, they depicted a heavy surveillance all around Patsy Fuca. This heavy surveillance, they ended up linking him to a visiting French television host. So there's another one, another anomaly, another thing that'll jump out at you. What is this guy doing with this well-known French television host?
Maybe now, the television host realized it was Gene Hackman.
Yeah, really. Now, in reality, that's the film. Now, in reality, the task force was conducting a 24-hour-a-day surveillance on Patsy Fuca. They followed him everywhere. They were on his phone. They linked him to other known heroin smugglers. One of the phone intercepts led them to the leader of the French Connection, a tall, dapper Frenchman named Jean Jehan. Now, the guys, Fuca and them, that were dealing with him, they were having a hard time pronouncing his name, and so they just referred to him as the Giant. They gave him the moniker, the nickname, the Giant, whenever they were on the phone. So when they heard him talking about the Giant, they figured out they were talking about Jean Jehan. The film version kind of dramatizes the flamboyant side of the story. You know, right now, I've worked these cases before, so you've got him linked up to all these people. You've got these connections coming and going. You're frantically listening for something that will give you a clue that maybe you can put him in the same room with dope, or you can connect him with somebody that you can put a case on and get them to flip, or because you're not going to send anybody in cold. You can't walk into the Luncheonette and say, hey, give me a little bit of heroin, or here's $50,000, give me a kilo or something like that, offer them an exorbitant amount of money. It's really hard to get in on these guys, so you just got to keep after. Now, one of the real big departures from reality was the French gangster, Jean Jehan, figured out that Popeye was following him around. Gene Hackman's following him around. So they hire, his organization hires a hitman to take him out. Well, the hitman gets on the roof of an apartment close to where Gene Hackman's going home and takes a shot at him and misses him. And so then there's a one of the more famous, one of the earlier car chase scenes that kind of set the stage for all future car chase scenes. I think Bullet came along just before this car chase scene. But Popeye, the guy gets on a elevated train. Popeye commandeers a car from somebody. And I don't, you've surely seen those scenes, Aaron, where he's going at, you know, at a wild rate of speed underneath an elevated train, and he almost hits a woman crossing the street pushing a stroller. Another car crashes into him, and he crashes into a bunch of garbage and then comes out of it and keeps going. And actually, that scene was a little side bit. That was a guerrilla scene they shot. They did not get
permissions
or have the streets all blocked off. They did it early in the morning when there wouldn't been many people around, and they had some of their own cars and own, you know, that woman and with a pushing a baby carriage was their people, were actors, but they didn't totally block off the seats. Now, they had a bunch of, like Eddie Egan and Sonny Grasso and some of their buddies were all working off duty, helping them with the movie, you know, being technical advisors and hanging out at the set and helping them with any police things, but they didn't want to pay a whole bunch of policemen to come in and lock down this whole area like they would today. So at one point in time, a citizen in a car stumbles right into the middle of it, and they almost hit him. I'm not sure if that ended up in there. There are several clips, Aaron. There are several clips of this scene with some analysis on YouTube. So it's kind of, it'd be interesting. I'll put a link up on the show notes, but that's kind of an interesting review of filming this most, one of the more famous car scenes, car chase scenes.
Well, in the car chase scene, then what happens? Gene Hackman catches the guy?
No, oh, yeah, he ends up, finally, the guy throws he puts a gun on the brakeman or the motorman. They end up throwing the emergency lever. He jumps off the train, gets on the station, and Gene Hackman's gotten out of the car, and he ends up confronting him on a going up or down up a stairs, I believe, running from Gene Hackman, and he shoots him, kills him with one shot, with his snub-nosed 38. So that's... but it was a pretty exciting scene, I'll say that.
The difference between the movie there and the reality was this must have been the 60s because traffic in New York is just gridlocked
all
the time. Would not have made an interesting chase scene.
No, that's not an interesting chase scene.
Yeah, come on.
I know.
They would have hit somebody because they would have had to drive up on the sidewalk.
So, and also in the movie, there's going to be a car that figures into this. They're hiding the heroin in a car coming from France. And this French television host that I mentioned is the one that's bringing it in. So in a kind of a creative twist, and the cops learn about that the Buick, you know, on the wiretap, they learn that there's something coming in. It's a car, and it's coming to the United States. And they know it has something to do with this Frenchman. Well, in the movie, they... learn is coming in. They know it's important. They think it's probably got dope in it. So they watch it, and they follow somebody driving it off the boat and driving it away, and they just leave it. I believe it was either on the street or in the parking lot, and it just left unattended, which is totally unrealistic. Nobody would ever leave a whole, you know, if I were running that investigation, I'd say, you know, there's no dope in that thing. But they, you know, they're convinced there is, so they steal the Buick, basically. They tow it into a garage, and they dismantle the car, basically, and finally find the heroin. So they put the car back together, leave the drugs in it, and then just set up a surveillance on it, and they follow it to where they think the drugs have been unloaded. And they end up having a raid at that location, and a big gunfight, of course, at the end. And the Frenchman, Jean Jehan, the giant, I can't remember what his name was in the movie. He's able to slip away, and part of it in the gunfight, Popeye kills one of the federal agents in a case of mistaken identity. So that was a pretty creative twist there, and that's kind of how the movie ended. But in reality, I'd rather deal with reality here. The task force has located Jean Jehan, or the giant, in a motel room in Manhattan, and they put a bug in it. And it's probably not a legal bug because nobody's really claiming responsibility for this bug that I can find in any of the news reports or any of the guys that have studied the case and written blog pieces on it.
What about the car coming over from France?
Well, they learn on that bug that someone's bringing a car in from France. That's how they learned it. And they know that has something to do with the dope. They know that there's a French TV host named Jacques Angelvin, A-N-G-E-L-V-I-N, Angelvin. And he's coming to the United States, so supposedly to pursue other work opportunities. And he's bringing a 1960 Buick Invicta. It's a huge, big car. I'll have a picture of it on the show notes on the webpage. It's a huge, big red car. And they know from the wiretaps and the bugs that the conspirators are all really interested in the arrival of this car. I was on one of these deals once, and nobody ever says exactly what's going on, but you know something's going to happen. They're all attuned, and they use little code words about something's going to happen, and you can it builds. It builds. The closer it gets, the more traffic. They call it chatter today. Is there any chatter on the about terrorist activities? Well, the excitement builds on the wire. They may not say exactly, they'll never say exactly what it is, but the excitement will start building, and they're like checking with each other, is it here yet, and what about that dude, and what about this, and I heard it was down at, they'll make up some code name for the pier, but, you know, you'll be able to figure out something's going on and pretty well somewhere around what it is. Of course, they're following these conspirators day and night. Follow Gene J. Han, and he's with another guy who they will later learn is his boss, a guy named Francois Scaglia. But anyhow, so they see Gene J. Han and Francois Scaglia watching cars being unloaded, and they're looking for a car. So they lock down on J. Han. He figures out he's under surveillance, and really this happened in the movie. In the movie, he jumps up and on the subway until he loses his surveillance, and they really did that in the movie, so that was the exact way that he got away from. He left town. The car, they don't know where this car is. They know it's here. He warns the others that there's a surveillance afoot. Well, these guys, they wanted to get this deal done, and he'll soon come back into town a few days later. Now, Robin Morney's book, The French Connection, claims that the agents on the wiretap heard Scaglia call Jacques Angevin, the French TV host, and ask him to bring the Buick to an underground garage. So, you know, that full court press surveillance for sure. The Buick arrives. They're sitting all around the garage. So you're sitting there watching. You see the Buick go in. You don't know who all's in. You figure maybe this Scaglia's in. Pretty soon, Tony Fuca, Patsy's brother, exits with the car, and they follow the car to a body shop, which is kind of known as a mob chop shop. Now, they kind of figure maybe that's when they took the dope out, but they just sit and watch it and wait for it to come back, or watch and see where it goes, and the story gets a little bit murky, and depending on who tells the story, Eddie Egan will claim that he accidentally saw Patsy Fuca after he left the chop shop and tailed him back to the underground garage. Or the federal agents who were staked out on the underground garage said, we saw Patsy Fuca enter. Either way, the Buick Invicta, Francois Scaglia, some other unknown guy who turned out to be a Frenchman, the French TV host, Patsy Fuca, are all in the same place in this garage after it's been taken to a chop shop and then sent back. And they continue to sit on it, and I've been there, and all of a sudden everybody leaves in a different way. The Buick exits, driven by the Jack, the TV, French TV host. He picks up this Francois Scaglia, who's walked up and is out on the street. So part of the team followed the Buick away. Egan and a couple others follow Patsy Fuqua and this unidentified man, and then a short distance away on the street, Gene J. Han appears, and they pick him up. A few blocks down the street, this unidentified man leaves the car, continue on, following him, and a few blocks later, J. Han leaves the car carrying a blue valise. Egan and his team stay on Patsy Fuqua, and they don't have enough crews to cover all these other guys and just let them go. Well, here's where it really gets tense. So you've got two different surveillances going. They know they figure there's a huge load of dope somewhere in and among these guys, and probably a lot of money, because that's what just went down. A multi-kilo deal just went down between the Frenchman and the mob guys, between Fuqua and Francois Scaglia and Jean Jehan. So Sonny Grasso and a couple of guys are on Scaglia and Jacques. They end up stopping them for running red light and just have them call a district car over and have them transported and held in a precinct station. They're listening as Eddie Egan's following Patsy Fuqua. By this time, they learned that Fuqua has stopped by his house and seemingly hurriedly picked up his wife, who came out in a negligee. Now, this all of a sudden becomes a chase, and they're frantically trying to catch up with Egan. Egan's trying to stay with Patsy Fuqua and his wife, and they're running. And they lose him, actually. And then by chance, a member of the surveillance team accidentally spots him crossing the Brooklyn Bridge, and the chase is on until they finally got him stopped and arrested. So, I mean, he's got nothing on him, just he and his wife. They were running. They figured out they were under surveillance, and they weren't sure who knew what. So they were on the lam, so trying to go on the lam. Well, since this was a state wiretap, Aaron, we had the Federal Bureau of Narcotics involved, but it's a state wiretap, so Egan and Russo get a search warrant to search Patsy's home and several other homes that are connected to him. And that's kind of how you do that at the end. You figure out any place that they could hide the stuff that they've ever been practically and gin up some kind of probable cause to get a search warrant for those places. Well, in the house of Patsy's father, Joe Fuqua, and in the house of his brother, Tony Fuqua, in his father's house, they found 11 kilos in the ceiling of the basement and another 33 kilos in the home of Patsy's brother, Tony. They've seized the Buick by then. Of course, they arrested Scaglia and Jacques, the TV dude, and towed the car. So they, in the end, they will do an analysis of the heroin they seized in the home, and they found some just traces of heroin inside the door panels in the Buick, and they will be able to definitively say that that heroin are both from the same batches. So that will link Jacques, the TV dude, in with the whole case, and end up putting a case on him. I know it's a lot of stuff that we've gone through, and so I've got a few questions. You may have some questions too, but my question was, who was the real boss from France? And best I could figure out, it's this Francois Scaglia, who was a leader of a gang in Paris called the Trois Canards. That would be the Three Canards. I'm not sure what C-A-N-A-R-D-S. Maybe somebody, you guys out there that know French, might be able to explain that to us. And it's T-R-O-I-S, I think, Trois Canards.
Aren't canards like small wingtips? I always think of, on new planes, they have those little extra wing extensions.
Oh, yeah.
Aren't those canards? Although that might not be the same.
Yeah, I'm not sure. We'll have to look that up. Jacques Angevin, the French TV guy. I was curious, in my mind, how'd they convince this guy to participate? Well, what I learned was he was infatuated with Francois Scaglia's sister, plus he was a cocaine addict. Now, he would claim he had no knowledge of the drugs. Of course, I would, too. He was extremely popular in France. I mean, how do you convince a guy to take part in something like this? But, of course, what they told him was just, you're going to America anyhow. Take your car and let us borrow your car for a few days before and let us borrow it when you get over there. Of course, he's the one who actually drove it over to the garage where they ended up taking it out of the garage while he waited to a chop shop. So he had to know. He knew what was going on. Jean Jehan, the guy they called the Giant, never seen again. He was just like in the movie, they had the Frenchman that got away at the very end. And it's kind of ridiculous what they did in the movie. They had Popeye Doyle chasing after the Frenchman, or the would be the real Jean Jehan. I can't remember what his name was in the movie. They had Popeye Doyle chasing after him and shooting at him, and he shot at him and he missed. He killed a federal agent. It was a accidental killing of a federal agent when he was trying to chase down the Frenchman, and which was kind of ridiculous at best. But he did get away, because after he got out of Patsy Fuqua's car, nobody ever saw him again, and he went back to France. Matter of fact, they never even arrested him later on in life, because they probably didn't have really enough to, if nobody testified against him, he probably didn't have enough to get him.
Yeah, with that valise.
He was carrying a valise. Remember that? He was carrying a valise. You know what was in that? I found out what was in that, purportedly. $250,000, which had been a down payment from Patsy Fuca of the mob's money for that dope, which the law enforcement got, which the government got. There's an unknown guy that left the garage with Patsy Fuca. You know, you have this stuff, Aaron. You have a deal like this going down. All of a sudden, somebody you never heard of, never seen before, they show up. And you don't know who they are. And if you remember, he left with Patsy Fuca and then got out of the car a block or two down the street. And they went back to a hotel where they knew these guys had been staying, and where Jehan, I think, had been staying. And they found a guy registered as under just initial J. Moran. So, and he escaped totally. Nobody ever figured out who he was. The French TV host, Jacques, he got 5 years. As far as the other guys, hardly anything happened to them. Patsy and his brother, they got minimal sentences. Engelman, he served 5 years of his 6-year sentence. And he did the most time of anybody. And back in those days, those early drug conspiracy investigations, unless somebody is turned early and wears a wire and gets these guys, you know, on really, you know, saying some dirty stuff, and then can turn around and testify and saying, this is what this means, or you got like a Ken Ito that will come in and point him, say, yeah, he's a made guy. Yeah, that's his boss. That's how this works. Back in those days, you didn't really have that. Angelo Tamaro was never even charged with the case.
I'm kind of curious why they didn't swoop in on him when they knew the drugs were in the car, because they had pulled it off and found it, right? And they take the car back.
And that's in the movie. See, that's where we get mixed up.
That's why I get confused, because I'm like, why wouldn't they just bust him in the garage? Right.
In the movie, they left him in because they needed somebody in possession of it. They wanted one of their principals in possession of it.
But in real life.
In real life, they wanted one of their principals in possession of it. But they hadn't stolen the car and verified the drugs were in it in real life.
In real life, that was just the movie magic.
The movie magic was they stole the car and found the drugs and then put them back out on the street. In reality, you might do that, but you put them back out on the street with just a minimal amount with some fake drugs in there. You wouldn't let those drugs walk. That would be very, very embarrassing, because everything, you know, once you get back out on the streets, everything gets out of control. You don't know what's going to happen. Anything can happen, these surveillances.
Well, I'm waiting to hear about the real-life big car chases, because it sounds like all they did was tail them.
That's all they did.
Wouldn't have been really very interesting movie, The French Connection. All we're doing is tailing them.
Well,
you've done a tail before. You're not speeding.
Tails can be exciting, depending on what you're doing.
Yeah, if you pull up to the stoplight next to Tuffy.
Well, excitement excitement is relative, maybe. If you're there's a certain tension to running a big surveillance like this, where you've got 4 or 5 people and you're trading off, and somebody's got the eye, who's got the eye, who doesn't. Oh, we lost him. He pulled in this parking lot. Okay, I'll get out and go in on foot and see if I can see where he went. They can get pretty tense and excited, but not exciting from a movie standpoint. Only in a movie standpoint, when you're like just doing all kinds of crazy stuff, is it going to get exciting?
Which is like 5% of the time.
Yeah, every once in a while. In that kind of work, you never really get a car chase that I've ever been in. I guess they did have kind of one at the end with Fuca, but... And in reality, Eddie Egan, when he was chasing Patsy Fuca and his wife, he would have called the district car, and they would all been swooping in and cut him off somewhere. So if it goes very long, your district car is going to get him anyhow.
What happened to Angelo?
Angelo Tumanaro, who was a Lucchese member, I don't know if he was a capo. I don't think he was a capo. I wrote down he was a capo, but in hindsight, I realized that I did not have any documentation on that. But he was a made guy. Angelo Tumanaro was never charged in the case, but he was eventually murdered in prison several years later.
I mean, I would think in a situation where they lose a bunch of heroin, that somebody's gonna end up dead.
when it comes to
the Lucchese crime family.
Right. They lost the $250,000. I think that's all they were really out, because he gave Jehan the Giant $250,000, is what best I can learn. He gave him that money, and they had the heroin out of the car, and they had it in their houses. But what I read was that was just a down payment, although it may not have been. there may have been a bunch more money that they'd already given to them, and so they lost the money, all the money and the heroin. But yeah, many times, like in Chicago, how many times the guys that screwed up the hit on Ken Ito, they found them dead shortly thereafter. You know, I don't really know. I'm not sure. I didn't really check into exactly why Tumanaro was killed if we knew a reason.
Well, but the Frenchman, he was part of that French connection.
Yeah.
I mean, and they bring the heroin over in the car, and then they, you know, however the heroin comes over, and they get it out. Someone's got to pay for that heroin.
Right, and that's what the $250,000 was part of it.
So I could see him.
Partial payment.
I could see him getting a valise and full of money and walking away.
Well,
because he probably has to turn around and go back and give that money to somebody else.
Oh yeah. Yeah, we don't really know, except for that $250,000 that he ended up with. That's all we know about the money, how much more money, because there have been a whole lot more. I mean, that was, $250,000 was only enough for about 10 kilos, and we're talking up around 100 kilos. So you're looking at what, $2.5 million probably, cash money that should have been out there somewhere.
So you're thinking they fronted them.
You know, I don't know.
I don't know enough
about how they did business. I would not think that they would front heroin, but there probably would be an easier way to pay $10 million for heroin than in a valise. There's probably other methods of payment that they had rather than dealing that much cash at this level of organized crime.
Well, so, but actually, Egan and Russo, when they went into the houses, they found 11 kilos in one house and 33 kilos in another home.
Right.
Not all, that was not all of the heroin.
Oh, I said 100, didn't I? No, I think it was that amount there. It was would have been, what, 33 and 12 would have been 45 kilos of heroin. I think that was all there was.
So what happened to the two actual detectives, Sonny Grosso?
I'm glad you asked that question. They went on to the movie business. You know, Eddie Egan was in Police Story. He was in two or three others. Sonny Grosso, he ended up doing some producing, and I don't think he did any acting like Eddie Egan did, but he did some producing and got involved in the movie business, bringing scripts to, trying to sell scripts to producers and promote movies, and ended up, retired, and that was the rest of their life. Now,
and then they became technical advisors on the film, The French Connection.
Yeah, they got that too. Got that going for them too, and they probably paid him something because they probably had to pay the Robin Moore for the rights for his book. But his book was all about, that was their story, so I'm sure they got a piece of that action too. I don't know how that works.
I was going to say, what happened to the heroin?
They took all this heroin down to the property clerk, to be held for evidence, and eventually I think everybody ended up copping pleas. So you cop a plea, you don't really even bring the evidence back out, and eventually. There's a time frame on this. They'll send the a little evidence chit, shall we say, up to the narcotics sergeant, whoever the narcotics sergeant is. They'll say, can this be destroyed? It's been 10 years or whatever, 5 years. It's been a certain period of time. Can this be destroyed? And you'll say yes or no. You'll take a look at the case file. So it was about 6 months before it was scheduled to be destroyed, all the French Connection heroin. And when a clerk happened to notice a bag, and the property room was broken open, and there were some little beetles crawling inside it, and there were, and it was like a white powder. So you don't figure beetles are going to crawl in and out of heroin and survive, but they will crawl in and out of flour. So they start checking it, and all of it was flour. So they start checking the logs, and somebody who signed in as a detective had signed that dope out at one time. And then probably and brought it back once, and they had no idea who it was. It was not a real detective.
It's probably somebody from the Lucchese crime family with an inside connection.
There's a whole story on that. Well, we'll save that for next time. It's a heck of a story of incompetence and corruption and the New York City Police Department. And poor old Eddie Egan and Sonny Grosso, they will kind of be under suspicion once this all comes up, and they didn't have anything to do with it. They just worked the case.
They never checked the heroin back out.
No, wasn't their names on it.
Yeah, pretty hard for a beetle to tie off and inject heroin, let alone hold the spoon. And I just was watching the Ray Charles biopic, and he was, I guess, a heavy heroin.
Oh, yeah, he was, wasn't he? I found a little saying here. William Burroughs. You know William. You know who William Burroughs is?
A writer.
He was an author. Lived in Lawrence. Actually, died out in Lawrence. But he was a real famous author in the 50s, and was a famous heroin addict too. One of the more famous heroin addicts. And William Burroughs says junk is the ultimate product, the ultimate merchandise. No sales talk is necessary. The client will crawl through a sewer and beg to buy. So that be heroin. You know, it's a pretty addicting drug.
When they take the poppy, and in Turkey, it's actually legal to grow it because they use it, they sell it to the companies that manufacture medicines, I thought.
Yeah, sure. Morphine.
Like morphine, yeah.
Yeah. What those farmers were doing back then, I don't know. You know, it's really changed from now. But back then, they could grow opium. They could grow opium poppy, sell it to legitimate pharmaceutical companies. They just were growing extra, and the Corsicans
were buying that.
And then they shipped it to the Frenchmen, and the Frenchmen were sending it over to the United States to the Italians, and then the Peckerwoods and the Blacks were all out there shooting it. So
they probably when it went from Turkey to France, and it probably got cut.
Oh yeah, well it got distilled down to a paste. You don't really cut it; it'll be pretty pure when you get it to a big dealer in the United States. It'll still be pretty darn pure. Then they start cutting it, and then the next guy cuts it, and then the street guy cuts it even more. So that's when the cutting starts. That's how you know cocaine or heroin, either one. That's how you know how recently it is into the United States on depending on the
purity.
The purity of it. All right. So I think we've handled that story pretty well, Aaron.
Now I have to go watch the movie The French Connection.
You have to. It's really a good movie. I saw on YouTube. I think somebody's got it up there. It'll probably be free. I think it'll probably be real low res or something, but it might be up there. I think I saw that when I was looking for clips. Anyhow, if you have a friend or a relative with a problem with drugs or alcohol or heroin, you know, heroin's a big heroin epidemic in the United States now, they say. Make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, folks, you need to go out and get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available for rent or purchase on Amazon. And, of course, you want to go through ganglandwire.com to make all of your Amazon purchases just so you can wet our beak. Give us a taste. Give us a cut in on your deal, because now we receive a kickback from Amazon for every purchase you make.
Yeah, I've already looked in there, and I've gotten a few, Aaron. So, folks, keep going to our banner, and you're going to buy something from Amazon. Buy it through our banner.
Just buy it through our banner. Food, movies, books, whatever they've got on Amazon.
And I'd prefer you bought a refrigerator, but...
Right. If you needed one, it's a good place. And then what you want to do is get Gary's app, the Kansas City Mob Tour app. For $1.99, you can take your own personalized tour of notorious locations in and around Kansas City. And if that's not enough, you need to get Gary's book, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
And after you've read the book, you're going to want to get the Kindle version, because the Kindle version, even better than just the book, because it has hyperlinks to video files with the actual audio with the words from the mouth of the men that did it.
That's right. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron. Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.